busy, yeah? So we have folk from the East Coast, from the West Coast, from almost the West Coast, local, far and near, gathering at Tisserana. It's pretty good, yeah? It's really great, I think. So it's wonderful to be here. Experiment with the mosquitoes. So they're starting to come. I'd like to just see if I could explore this. There's an idea that you'll find in Indian spirituality and in Buddhism of instant enlightenment and the gradual path. You read about that a lot, right? So maybe I could see if I could explore that. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, by the way. So the instant enlightenment, the idea, I suppose, is you're already enlightened. There's nothing to do. That would be a clumsy way of saying it. And the gradual path is that you can kind of chip away, you know, you keep chipping away, you keep going, thousands of lifetimes. That would also be a crude way of saying it. The idea, so there's one that's you're already enlightened, the other is you just got to keep working at it. And again, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. So if you begin with how the Thai forest tradition, through Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah, and so on, how we talk about now is the knowing. In the Thai they say puru, be the knowing. Awakened consciousness. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. All these ideas are that awareness is pure. You can't purify awareness. Neither can you sully it. So the pure consciousness, awakened consciousness, is already pure. And you can't really become that, you can only be that. You can only awaken. If I think about it, this doesn't make sense to say, well, I'm gonna awaken tomorrow. Right? It just doesn't make sense, it doesn't compute. Whereas if you really understand that, what awakened consciousness is talking about is simply really knowing this is the way it is now, and you know, we come back to that. And that needs to be, as I was saying this afternoon, you have to recognize that. It's rather like when Ajahn Kusa and I walked through the bush and we went on one of those many Pike Lake roads and we had the address and then, oh, there's Denny's. There's Denny's Cottage. You recognize it. You say, that's Denny's Cottage. Or you're traveling across, you know, Highway 7 and you say, oh, that's the Mississippi River. You recognize it. You know it. You recognize it, right? So the same with... or a person, whatever, but the same with awakened consciousness, you just have to keep recognizing this is it. Right? Okay, so that's already pure, no place to go. And that can only be present moment, present moment, present moment. It has no past and future. So, but if you think about your own practice, I think about my practice, I'm a better person for having worked at this life, you know, for these number of years. There's less greed, hatred, delusion, less fear, there's more compassion, more happiness. And certainly it wasn't the same as when I entered the monastery. It is different, you know, there has been a change. I can only recognize that in memory. Memory is always just a present moment thing. So, but how did that take place? How did that take place? And what does that change imply? Well, that change doesn't imply that the purity of consciousness is any different, right? The awareness is always the awareness, right? But what it seems to me it happens is actually the problem is how does awareness get kidnapped? Or how does that... pure consciousness get unrecognized, maybe that would be it, unrecognized, right? And how does it get unrecognized, or how do we not recognize it? It's because we become enwrapped in thoughts and fears and worries and the whole kind of stuff that we experience as human beings, is which we call delusion or lack of mindfulness. Now, if the path were, I think where people confuse the gradual path as being wrong, the wrong definition of gradual path would be that there's something wrong with me now, and I've got too much fear, I have too much anger, and all that, and in the future I'll be a better person if I can get rid of this, and that would be a viewpoint which is invested with self-view. Something wrong with me now, and I have to get rid of all this stuff, and then in the future I'll be a better, happier person. And that would, I think that's where, when people talk about instantaneous enlightenment, think the gradual path is wrong. But that would be wrong view in Buddhism. Yeah. Right view would be that this condition has arisen, how can I sustain awakeness around it? And if I can sustain awakeness around it, right, then it has no power over that. It doesn't delude that sense of awakeness. So, I think we all have seen this, say that the tendencies to get swamped by conditions, be it tendencies of fear or greed or depression or anger or whatever, these tendencies are so powerful, it's very hard, it's very difficult to stay awake to them. We get caught up in thoughts, we distract. We go into kind of programmed modes of thinking and so on. So the challenge is to sustain this awakened consciousness, to sustain that, to keep sustaining. But that's always a very, very present moment. It's never in the future or past. Right? And if you think about how some of your, or if I think about my own, how some of the fears, you know, fear is less powerful, anger is less powerful, lust is less powerful, all these things, I don't get depressed anymore and all those things. Well, how does that work? Well, in a sense it's gradual, but it's also instantaneous. Because the way it works is that, let's say my mind is moving towards some depressed state, and I've suffered, and I've worked with it, understood it, and I just wake up, oh, this is what depression feels like, right? And then, and the sustaining of that is always present moment, present, knowing, and that's what the enlightenment is about, isn't it? You're enlightened to the feeling of depression. So it's both instantaneous, on the moment, in the moment, and yet it's also gradual, isn't it? Because the tendencies that we get deluded by are so powerful they overwhelm awareness. But it's not that there's anything wrong with me and I have to become something in the future. So if you take it to the Four Noble Truths, then you have to kind of conjoin this with the Four Noble Truths. Third Noble Truth, the way that's put out, is that there is an end of suffering, and that's the end of craving. This end must be realized. This end has been realized. That's the way they phrase it, right? The twelve ways of the Four Truths. So the second noble truth is that there is a cause. This cause has to be abandoned. This cause has been abandoned. Third noble truth, there is an end to suffering. There is an end to craving. This has to be realized. It has been realized. Now if you take that, and I used to take that as a kind of final product, right? In which case you could never realize the third noble truth. If somewhere in the future I'll realize the complete ending of suffering. But then, Ajahn Sumedho said, well, how can you work with that then? And how does that, how can you use that idea of Third Noble Truth as a reflective tool, if it's just something in the future that I'm going to finally realize, Nibbana, after I do what I do? So you have to learn how to use that right now. Now, when I wake up to maybe the mind complaining about something, oh, that's complaining. That's the end of craving. That's the end of ego. That has been realized, right? Right there, your mind is in the awake state, awakened consciousness. It's this way now, and that And that's what I think the Third Noble Truth is talking about. You realize, that's it, you're back. Now, it might be very unpleasant, what you're waking up to. It might be very yucky, and that's the problem. Right? The problem is that to actually stay awake to some very difficult states of mind, and not just pursue the beautiful states of mind, you know, not to get into this push and pull, but to let the beautiful states of mind be fully what they are, but to actually sit and be with a state of negativity, you know, some kind of strong negative state of mind, fear or depression, and fully be awake to it, fully conscious of it, without craving. That's the challenge, isn't it? Because your whole system has been conditioned for how many years, right? That as soon as some negative states of mind come up, to attach to the craving, to see the compensation, to blame, to distract, to think. Right? So, awakening to that, and abandoning the craving pattern, and realizing this is the end of craving, this is the end of suffering, is what pure consciousness is about. And every time I just recognize, I think that's important, it's just this way now. You don't have to touch it. Just hang in. And it's the hanging in that the Bharamitas are about, to some extent. So I was saying earlier today, determination. You know, some yucky state comes up, you have to be determined to just stay with it. Because the craving mind will want to distract, won't want to be with it. And then you find that in retreats, don't you? You come to a retreat and it's some really, you know, difficult state of mind comes up and you have forbearance. Teacher says, hang in there. Be aware, feel it in your body, whatever you do. So you have like forbearance, kanti paramita. You have determination. You have this kind of, I'm gonna watch this now. I've been distracting this one and eating chips and listening to Grateful Dead too long, right? I'm gonna really look at this one now. And you do, right? So that's determination. You have this determination. Why? Because you're a mature practitioner now. You know, it's not just, I'm going to be determined. You're really, I want to understand this thing. So adhitana, determination. Forbearance, you're willing to be with it. Patience, right? Forbearance, patience. You sit with this yucky state. And what happens is all those paramitas are contributing to this awakened consciousness now hanging in there or sustaining itself or whatever you want to call it for a longer period of time. You know, whereas before, some difficult state of mind, you might have just distracted it, blamed yourself, did whatever number you did with it. You don't do that now. And that's instantaneous too, in a way, and yet it's gradual in a way. You're not becoming someone who is more patient in the future, but right now, you're getting all this kind of equipment together and really doing the work, and that's present moment, and yet it's gradual. You can see it's both ways. It's both ways. Where the people who talk about gradual path would disparage the people who talk about instantaneous enlightenment, would say, yeah, but look what you did yesterday, you turkey. You know, you're completely awash with your emotions yesterday. What do you mean? Right? And so that doesn't seem to fit. So I kind of see both ways. I see that the path has to be always here and now, instantaneous, because there's only the present moment to work with. You can only wake up now. And yet, the tendency to get overwhelmed are there. And I do see, and we all see, having worked at this for whatever number of years, we are better people, no matter what your self-disparaging mind says. Right? We are better people for this. You know, we are happier, and we are easier to get along with, and we're more forgiving, and we are more patient, etc., etc. And yet that's always done in the moment. So I think that, for me, what's very important is to really understand these truths, especially like to, what does the abandonment of craving mean? And is that fully understood in right understanding as a necessary part of the Buddhist project. If I really understood what the abandonment of craving is, or do I just feel that I should not do whatever I shouldn't be doing? You know, is it just a kind of duty? I will now abandon craving, as the Buddha said. Or do I really understand that that could be the only way? That could be the only way which would lead to the liberation from attachment to craving, to the sense world. Right? So you go back to the whole, you know, why are you doing this? And what is the project? And why is the Buddha making such a deal around craving? And what is craving? And what is the difference between craving and just normal desire? And you have to have a right understanding about all of this. Right? So you go back and then you say, well, okay. You go back and I guess you like in your spiritual practice, like, do you sense that there is a profound possibility in consciousness which equates to the Buddha's enlightenment, whatever that might be? Do you have that yearning, aspiration, faith, trust, belief? Is that a part of your understanding? Because I think without that sense that there is a profound possibility, I don't think you'd have Buddhism. You might have therapy, right? You might have kind of good mindfulness practice, but I do sense that without that, without this Buddhist statement, there's the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, and the unformed, I don't see how you would then take on the project of letting go of the sense world. Right? I don't see how. Maybe you would, because the sense world becomes, well, you'd probably moderate it. But anyway, it seems to me that statement of the Buddha, that mindfulness is a path to the deathless, that you recognize what mindfulness is, and that you recognize that there is a way of being, whatever you want to call it, which is not a sense experience, you know, which isn't the same as comfort and happiness. That it is of a different, it's a whole different, how do you talk about it, you know? It's different. So if that makes sense to you, then the movement towards the senses now, the movement of trying to get the emotions always right, or trying to get the body right, or trying to get sounds right, that kind of movement always to try to rearrange sense consciousness, that no longer makes any sense, right? And that's where the teachings of anicca dukkha anatta make sense. Anicca dukkha anatta are pointing to the uncertainty of it, that that's not where it can be. It's not wrong. You know, it's not wrong to have a cappuccino and potato chips. It's not wrong to listen to the Grateful Dead. But it's not Nibbana, right? So I think there's a shift in consciousness when you realize, okay, it can't be out there, but there's nothing wrong with out there. You know, it's not a repressive teaching, but that can't be where it's at. Where you then are willing to bear witness to yucky things. Because, you know, I often had that in a monastery when I was fed up and I was ready to put on the jeans. I'd say, yeah, but where are you going to go? If you can't be with this, because there can't be any object, there can't be any sense experience that could possibly work, right? So that's where renunciation comes in. So you have Nekama Paramita. Nekama Paramita is renunciation, and that's not simply donning the whites, right? But it's a shift of where you think the goal might lie. It's a shift away from seeking spiritual fulfillment in objects to coming back to that which knows objects. Right, and then the abandonment of craving makes a lot of sense. Because it's not a repressive thing, but it's thinking, yeah, because if I'm always just trying to fulfill myself through craving, I'll always be looking at objects which are always anicca dukkha anatta. they're uncertain, they're unsatisfactory, you know, they can't work. So you're left with what? You're left with, this is the way things are. Instant enlightenment. Not because you've rejected anything, because this is the only place it could be. Couldn't be outside of you. Can't be an object, can't be a sound. You're trapped. You're trapped into enlightenment, right? And that's intellectual. But I think it's very important to contemplate why the Buddha said that the conditioned world is unsatisfactory. You know, it's not just, it's like when he talks about anicca, it's not just about changing weather. We all know that. It's not just about the leaves becoming brown in the fall. We all know that. But why did he stress this uncertainty around sense experience, around sight and sound and emotions and all that? Why did he do that? Well, because he was said that mindfulness is the path to the deathless, because he realized something. You know, he realized something in his own consciousness. Huh? So if that somehow makes sense, then you begin to see what dukkha is about. Dukkha isn't just about being unhappy. It's that the sense experience itself is unsatisfactory. Even so, you begin to see this kind of paradox that unhappiness is unsatisfactory, which doesn't mean we go around pricking each other with pins, you know, and drinking coffee with salt in it or something. We don't hurt ourselves. We just realize that the sense experience is actually very irritating. You know, it's an irritation. And we like nice irritation. You know, but if you look at how your sense body works, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, it's an irritant. Now that, you know, that's a pretty wet blanket way to look at sense consciousness. And if we only had sense consciousness, then it would seem like such a bummer. Buddhism would seem such a downer. You know, oh God, he gave one of those talks about life being an irritant. You know, and it would seem so awful. And then you'd see me enjoying a cup of coffee. Well, look at the guy. What a hypocrite. And I only got instant coffee. So, but the point of it is, you see, the point of it is to redirect our attention. Not to make a prudish statement, some kind of a judgmental statement about sense consciousness. And that's why I think sometimes we can get confused with Buddhism, because we can pick up ideas, like puritanical ideas from other epochs and other traditions, which looked at like having fun as being not good, evil, you know. So we can pick up the ideas of dukkha and the abandonment of craving from a wrong mindset, the mindset of puritanism, right? But that's something we have to look at, like culturally. But that's not what the Buddha was pointing to. So all these conditions are dukkha. They're unsatisfactory. So that's not where you look. You don't look there, right? And then he says they're anicca, they're changing. And then he says, like Ajahn Sumedho would say, what does a Buddha know that others don't know? A Buddha knows that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. And it's not self. And, you know, all right, that's a Buddha, knows that. But what happens if you actually do that? What happens if I actually feel like, if I feel irritable, and I, in the past, I've dumped it on someone in the monastery, and now I feel irritable, and I pick up the Buddhist position, say, that which has the nature to arise is a nature to cease, and it's not mine. I become a witness, right? I begin to know objectively, and in its ceasing there is peace. So that mice that comes and goes, and and you can see what Ajahn Sumedho is talking about there. He says, that's being Buddha. What do Buddhas know that others don't know? That's just the nature to rise, that's the nature to cease, not self. And you actually do that, you know life in that way, really changes. The other way is I shouldn't feel irritable. I should do more metta practice, right? I should do more metta. Oh, do more metta. I'm still someone becoming something, not instant enlightenment. I wake up, I think, wow, I'm really pissed off. And I just feel that. Then I can do some metta practice. May I be free from anger. You know, I can do that. But it's no longer from becoming anything. You know, it's putting right effort in, into the heart, into the mind. So right effort comes from right understanding. And you have to work this out yourself. I mean, this is the way I've worked it out. And I'm pretty convinced. Right? So I have faith. But my faith is grounded in having really kind of suffered and pondered. Why do you say this? How does it work? Right? You have to come to your own sense of that, of this being correct. Then it only makes sense. Then it only makes sense that the letting go of craving is the only logical way of liberation. Not, it's not just a teaching. You know, it's only logical. Then when these difficult states of mind come up, there's right understanding there. And from right understanding you get this right intention. Samasankapa, right thought. You know, you're now your whole intellectual system is now in line with Dhamma. Right? And so then you know you begin to like your determinations that you make aren't from ego anymore. The adhitana, I should be more kind. So, no, I'm going to wake up to unkindness. You know, it's not from self-disparagement or from being a bad person or, you know, all those things that we do to ourselves. It's simply Dhamma. You practice Dhamma. Then when things come up, your determination becomes conjoined with like forbearance. I'm just going to bear with this. You know, well, I know you more, that kind of thing. The whole path kind of comes to, all those things come together to this idea of this is the way it is now. And you see how difficult it is to sustain this is the way it is now. It's very hard to do, isn't it? This is the way it is now. But I don't want it this way. Mm-hmm. Or I'd rather have whatever I want, right? So thought and desire and the past and the future and then habit. Habit comes into play. Maybe like with sickness. I was saying about tiredness this morning, but like sickness. Maybe every time I get sick, I just go into feeling sorry for myself. So then not only do you have the difficulty of like knowing the way things are, you have difficulty of a habit taking those ego structures in a certain direction, creating a sense of you, because you've always done it that way. Every time I felt sick, I feel sorry for myself. Mom will give me grapes or something like that, right? Whatever the way we do it. So then we're dealing with what we call anusaya, asava anusaya. Anusaya is like latent tendencies, right? These are the kind of habitual patterns that we face, and it's very hard to be mindful of those. And then they come out, it's what we call asava. They come out of consciousness, they flow out, the outflows, we say. They're kind of flowing out of consciousness. So it's quite easy to say this is the way it is now. It's quite hard to sustain that for periods of 4 seconds. Or a minute. Or an hour. Or a day. Right? And yet, we find, as we do this, if we encourage ourselves in the right way, we've been actually aware for 15 minutes. This is the way it is now. And I think, for me, a big piece of it is really... I use this word recognize today, aren't I? Really recognize. That's Denny's cottage. Or, that's the fork to the road. Oh yeah, that's the turn off to Powers Road. You recognize. You know, that's it. So you when you know your mind is in a muddle, and then it kind of catches up, and you think, oh, that's it. I'm here. Good. Make it positive. And then, oh God, I've been lost again. I'm not being mindful again. Don't go there. Oh good. You know, this is it. And then taste the moment. And open your mind to that moment. Make it 2 moments. Like that. The whole path becomes quite beautiful because all these things begin to make sense. You know, they all kind of fit in. You see why the Buddha's mentioning these things. So as you read these teachings and you kind of go back to them again and again and again, keep trying to make them a part of your particular karma, right? part of your particular habit patterns and what you have to work on. Because that's where they become really alive. If they're just abstracts, you can agree with them or not. But they have to be, you know, you have to see them as you're living through your life, really enliven them. All right, I'll leave that for contemplation tonight.